in your presence this morning. We've got important work to do. And so thank you for being here with us. We have a special guest today, Kathleen Gaylord, who is the chair of the Property Tax Working Group. She is also a commissioner in Dakota County. And Commissioner Gaylord, we are so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I should refer to you as Madam Chair as well. So.
Thank you. Greetings. Well, good morning. I'm very pleased to be here, this is a very august group that I think understands this issue very well, and hope I appreciate some of the work that's being done in the Property Tax Working Group. I am Kathleen Gaylord. I am a commissioner in Dakota County. I was appointed to the working group by the Minnesota Association of Counties, and I was elected the chair of the group at the first meeting, so I'm here today in that capacity as the chair of the Property Tax Working Group. The working group is made up of a variety of individuals. These are mostly citizens rather than tax experts. We've spent a lot of time learning about the details of the property tax system, and we've been given what we sometimes see as an impossible task, but we're tackling it and moving forward. I do want to acknowledge that two of the members on our group are two members of this committee as well, Senator Limmer and Senator Scoey, so appreciate their participation in the group as well. Our charge from the legislature, they tasked us to investigate ways to simplify the property tax system. When we're talking about simplifying the system, we're talking about reducing the complexity of the system. As you'll see in upcoming slides, little changes over time have built what is perhaps one of the most complicated property tax systems in the nation. We're also looking at ways to make it more understandable. This refers to how we communicate with taxpayers. We're doing an analysis to try to see how are we doing in terms of making it easier for people to understand their property taxes. Our charge also includes a couple of other things. We've been asked to also examine the property tax calendar. Currently, the property tax calendar is a system, a cycle that lasts about 2 years. It means that when you pay your taxes in 2012, it is for 2011 property values, which have been determined by prior year sales. This continues to be a source of confusion and frustration for taxpayers. Initial discussions with the Department of Revenue suggest that shortening this cycle will not be an easy task, but we are exploring whatever changes are possible. In addition, we've been asked to determine whether the complexity that we have in the property tax system, including classifications, credits, aids, exclusions, exemptions, abatements, whether all this is beneficial, or whether there are other ways to achieve the goals that are simpler and more cost-effective. Property taxes in Minnesota were first levied 163 years ago. The first territorial assembly levied the first property tax in 1849 at 0.25%. The tax was a general tax. It was applied to all property at the same rate. 9 years later, when Minnesota joined the Union in 1858, the property tax was the chief source of revenue. The first state tax was also a general tax of 5 mils. Under the Constitution, all taxes on property shall be equal and uniform across the state. Before assessors became the professionals that we have today, with the training and the standard procedures and computers, uniform assessment was a challenge. Inexperienced assessors would fail to value all the property. They would rely on the values suggested by taxpayers. Obviously, this created a lot of inequities across the state. An early study showed that household goods, for example, were only being assessed at about 25% of value. Rural properties were being taxed less than urban properties. In 1860, the State Board of Equalization was created to try to deal with some of these situations, but it wasn't able to do enough, and problems and delinquencies continued to grow and impact revenues. To compensate for the loss of revenue, Governor Alexander Ramsey cut the salaries of state officials, reduced the size of the legislature, and submitted a constitutional amendment to cut the length of the legislative session to 60 days. Expenses were cut, and property taxes were reduced 20%. This happened in 1862.
That's a man after my own heart, I have to say, Madam
Absolutely.
Chair.
But the next year, the legislature figured this out.
60 days.
You've and got adopted
our attention,
a poll
now.
Tax rather than increase the property tax. So even in our very first years of statehood, it was clear that the property tax cannot be relied on for all costs of government. In the following years, it was determined that a uniform general tax was not practical, and to obtain better compliance and administration, property taxes should be classified. Personal property, livestock, and real estate are not equal and should not be treated alike. This led to the classified property tax system in Minnesota. It began in 1905 with the passage of the Wide Open Tax Amendment, allowing taxes to be uniform across the same class of property. The classification system as we know it today was first formulated in 1913 with the establishment of four classes of property that legalized what assessors had been doing to the various types of property. The Great Depression brought massive delinquencies and the demand for property tax relief. Three new classes were added to help homesteads and agricultural property, but the burdens increased on all the remaining properties. A new source of state revenue was needed to hold down property taxes, and the income tax was enacted. The 1933 changes were the first of many to the classification system. Classifications have been changed in virtually every session since 1941, and each change has added to the complexity of the tax. The state shifted to income taxes as its major source of funding over the next several years, and by the 1960s, only 6% of state revenues came from the property tax, although the property tax did account for 97% of local tax collections. In 1967, the state property tax was eliminated, and the collection of property taxes was turned over to the counties. 25% of the collections of the new state sales tax were then dedicated to property tax relief. Over the last 40 years, we've seen numerous changes in the property tax and continued attempts to provide property tax relief, from the Minnesota Miracle to the Big Plan to today. Minnesota added initiatives like the Income Adjusted Homestead Credit, or Circuit Breaker, in 1975, which is now known as the Property Tax Refund. The Truth in Taxation process began in 1988. These are key components of the system even today, and most personal property is now exempt. The state tax levy was eliminated, as I mentioned, in 67, but it returned in 2001 with the Big Plan. Levy limits were first added in 1971. They were repealed in 89. They came back in the 90s. They were repealed again in 2001. They've been brought back and repealed several times since then. We saw the creation of senior, renter, and homestead credits, fiscal disparities, disaster relief, new classifications, new classification ratios. A nationally unique tax capacity system replaced the mill rate system. Homestead treatment is allowed for some relatives. There are limited market values, new exclusions, credits, programs, the replacement of the homestead market value credit with the homestead market value exclusion, and many other changes, each perhaps individually justifiable, but collectively these many, many changes have left us with the most complex system in the nation. And all those little changes have added up. Classification is perhaps one of the most unique features of the Minnesota property tax system. The number of classifications continues to grow. In 1913, there were four classes, one for iron ore, one for household goods and personal effects, one for unplatted real estate, livestock, farm produce, and inventories and manufacture tools, and the fourth was for all other property. In 1933, they added the three classifications under the property tax to bring in homestead benefits, and there were also value-based tiers. But currently, we have 55 different classifications, counting all the separate tiers in the property tax system.
Sure.
And there are 9 different class rates assigned to those different classifications.
Madam Chair, just one moment. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the 2001 thing, did you look at how, is it 2011 or?
2011.
Oh. Do you know how many of those classification changes occurred in 2001 when the statewide business tax came about? I know there was a lot of work done at that time with rate compression and et cetera. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have that with me here, but we can certainly talk about, we'll probably be talking about that in the group, and you serve on the working group, so we can address that.
Thank you.
Thank you. The question becomes, does it need to be this complex? And the next few slides will try to illustrate some of the complexity of the property tax system. This slide shows half of the classifications in 2010. This shows the other half. The working group is trying to dig more deeply into the system. If you look at how the property tax is calculated, in general you'll say, well, you take the value of the property and you multiply it by a tax rate, and that becomes your tax bill. But each of the components of that calculation have numerous exemptions, exclusions, aids, other things that affect that, and it becomes very complex. But even this doesn't really tell you how complex the Minnesota system is.
Sweeten me up a little bit this morning.
This chart is perhaps the poster child for how complex our system has become. It's a chart that shows the calculation that is needed to be done by our assessors in order to determine if a property qualifies for the agricultural homestead classification. In our working group, we've discussed the 55 classifications and how many of them are really needed to make the important distinctions that are needed for tax purposes. We've explored significantly reducing the number of classifications. We set up a temporary separate committee to look and tackle the complexity of the classification system, and a second subcommittee to look at agricultural classifications.
Madam Chair, on that, I see that as such an important piece of your work to recommend either we return to the mill rate, and or that's a really big question in this one. How do you get from 55 classifications to a number that can be comprehensible and distinguishable?
And that's the whole idea, to try to make it a system that people can understand. And right now it is so complex that even people who profess to be tax experts in many ways have difficulty with our property tax system. So
I'm wondering, do you expect to make some recommendations about that, about how to simplify this system or transition to one that is less complicated?
Yes.
And what do you expect to be the timing of those recommendations?
Well, I'll get into that in a little bit, if you can.
All right, but it's a 2-year working group. I think it will help us all to understand where you're at with this.
It is a 2-year working group. Thank you, Madam Chair. Our charge is to present a report to the legislature in February of 2013. So we're basically midterm in our deliberations on the system. Because this is a group that is not a group of tax experts, we have spent a lot of our first several meetings going through the system in great detail to help them understand it. And it's been kind of interesting to watch some of the members as the light bulbs start to go on, as they start to say, hey, now I understand. I could never understand how this or that worked. Now I understand. So I think we've gotten ourselves to the point now where the members are much more comfortable in discussing the different components of the system and some of the ideas that are out there to try to deal with it. So it's been kind of an interesting evolution for the group as well.
Great. Thank you.
In addition to the classification system, we've really just begun to look at all of the different exclusions, credits, exemptions, to determine whether they're producing real benefits and to consider whether that those benefits justify the complexity that they add to the system. If you look at Minnesota statutes 272.02, that's the main statute that talks about exemptions in the property tax system. It grew from 44 subdivisions to 97 subdivisions in the last decade. It's far beyond the constitutional exemptions for things like public property, schools, hospitals, churches that most people associate with exemptions. Over 165,000 parcels are exempt from property taxes in Minnesota. Minnesota also has a wide variety of exclusions that apply to everything from metro-platted vacant lands to this old house to mold damage, lead hazards, disabled veterans are just a few. Again, over 80,000 parcels affected by these various exclusions. In addition, we now have the new homestead exclusion, which applies to over 1 million people. Tax credits include disaster credits, power line credits, agricultural preserve credits, the bovine tuberculosis credit, and more. We have multiple tax bases and deferments. In addition, we've got not only the state, but 87 counties, 1,802 townships, 366 school districts, 242 special districts, and 2,006 tax finance districts, tax or financing districts, all levying property taxes. So why do we care? Well, part of it is the impact that all this complexity has. The complexity is diminishing the transparency and the accountability of the system. It leaves room for error, promotes incremental changes which only make the problems worse. It's inefficient and it is expensive. Every time a small change is made in the system, 87 county assessors have to go in and figure out whether it applies to properties within their jurisdiction. And 87 counties have to go in and change computer systems in order to make that change. It leads to unintended consequences and inequities. It diminishes the ability of taxpayers, administrators, and policymakers to understand the system. It's this last one, this goal of communicating a better, being able to communicate better about the property tax system, one of our goals that is affected by this. And a complex system makes it much harder for us to communicate with taxpayers, with administrators, and with policymakers. We've been asked to look at the overall timeline for the property tax cycle. This is a graphic that kind of gives you a sense of the length of time that the whole process actually does take. Taxes again paid in 2012 will reflect 2011 valuations. As I mentioned before, looking at this cycle, the Department of Revenue says pretty much this is how long it takes to do everything. But we are continuing to look at how do we shorten that cycle. And one of the things we've focused on is the new concept of ECRVs. And as those become sent in electronically, information will be available on a more timely basis, and hopefully we'll be able to shorten some of the process at the front end because of that. We've discussed many items in the property tax working group. Some of which I've already mentioned, some of which we can look at a little bit more here later today. This slide, however, summarizes some of the things that we've talked about so far, including tax principles, the classification system, the calendar, and the various tax components. So where are we today? And the chairman asked a little bit about this. How are we doing in terms of coming up with some ideas? Currently, we have identified some initial concepts, and we're exploring how they interact with each other. These include just basically simplifying the system, a concept of trying to keep the property tax a local tax, having the benefits based on property rather than on owner, developing broad-based goals, delivering benefits outside of the property tax system, having value and intention statements, and instituting sunsets and mandatory reviews. We do have a consensus in our group that we do need to reduce the number of classifications, which will help increase the ability to understand the property tax system. We've looked at consolidating agricultural land and building classifications, providing the same benefits to ag and non-ag homesteads, eliminating various classifications. Initially, we're looking at trying to get it down to four basic classes. Whether we actually end up at four, I don't know, but we're kind of steering in that direction, a substantial reduction in the number of classifications within the system. We've also looked at a concept of confining the property tax to the local government. Most people believe that the property tax system is there to provide revenues for local government, and it is confusing when some of those dollars are taken by the state general tax. So we have looked at the possibility of eliminating the state general tax, which I understand is already been drafted into legislation, and trying to keep state funding for state mandates and keep the local property tax for local tax purposes. We've spent some time looking at how to make the property taxes more understandable for property owners. And some of the ideas have been on how to improve the property tax informational statements that go out to the various taxpayers, and looking at some of the information that's on those or not on those statements to help people better understand the property taxes. For example, the new market value exclusion, showing both the estimated market value and the taxable market value. On some property tax statements that went out this year, people only saw the taxable market value. They did not see the estimated market value, and so immediately assumed that their market values had somehow magically been reduced by $25,000 or $30,000, and very confusing for people. Better timing coordination of notices. You sometimes will get a notice based for your payable taxes for this year with a notice for valuations for next year almost at the same time. And it's confusing, which tax are you talking about, which year are you talking about. Providing basic budget information. The tax statements and the truth in taxation statements tend to focus on the tax, when in many instances they really should be focusing more on budget information and providing information so people understand what's happening with the levies in the local jurisdictions. If you look at a number of the notices, they'll have addresses, sometimes they'll have phone numbers, but most people communicate by email or want to look for a website, and one of the suggestions is that those kinds of addresses be added onto notices. Provide the more web-based detail. People don't really necessarily want to have government sending out tons of information about budgets and levies, but there are a lot of people that would like to get to that information. And trying to encourage people to establish a web-based site that people can go to and find out more about local budgets would be very helpful for people in terms of understanding the property tax. Also, we've looked at the truth in taxation process, and one of the key things that we see it being important to engage the taxpayers electronically. Again, this is how many people communicate and want to communicate. Rather than publish notices in newspapers that fewer people get, or in-person meetings, which are very not well attended. We've also been looking again at the property tax calendar. We think that there are ways to consolidate some of the reporting dates to simplify the basic assessment timeline, adjust some of the market definitions for sales comparison purposes, and modify some of the truth in taxation timelines, which will help shorten the property tax calendar. We've also looked at a number of the property tax components, targeting tax relief through the property tax refund or through the income tax rather than through a limited classification. Identifying policies or evaluation principles for the various tax preferences, identifying outdated and unused tax preferences. We've seen through the impact of our discussion that a lot of people are interested in property tax issues. Our group is not a property tax reform group. We have a relatively limited charge in that sense, looking at trying to simplify the system. We are somewhat encouraged by a lot of the interest in some of the work that we have done. The Department of Revenue is, as they are developing some of their forms for 2012 and 2013, have already noticed some of our consensus comments, and we may see some of those in those forms as they are developed. We've also seen legislators pursuing some of our ideas. But we hope that as we use the next year to continue to dig into the property tax complexities, to look at the pros and cons, to look at the interactions, to look at the consequences, we hope that we can develop some strong recommendations and are looking forward to working with members of this group and the committee as we make those recommendations to the 2013 legislature. And I appreciate being here. And certainly if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm so grateful for your work. I tell folks at home that it's nearly impossible for a legislator to show up on the first day of the legislative session with a good idea that's going to really change the property tax system and get it done that year. It can't be done. And what we really need are folks that will dig into these issues and make some strong recommendations. And so if I could send back a message to the working group, it would be please be bold and please make changes that will significantly improve this, make recommendations so that we can. When a group like yours comes back to the legislature with a recommendation, it has an incredible amount of influence with us. And we can then propose the recommendations that you make. We can study them. We can take them back to our districts. We can talk about them in our caucuses. We can get further review and analysis. And so those recommendations will have a great deal of power and influence with the folks that sit at this table and in the House and those that watch for tax issues at the Capitol. We are in your debt for having the willingness to dig in. This is not easy. And it's... there are lots of different interests, and the classifications are complicated, and anyone that is willing to really dig in with us on this issue deserves our great gratitude, and thank you so much for that. Now, there may be some questions from folks around here, but I, for one, am very much looking forward to seeing these recommendations and doing all in my power to work as a team with you to advance those recommendations. This is not an empty working group from my point of view. This is one we desperately need to advance the state's best interests. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate those comments. And again, I appreciate the participation of Senator Limmer and Senator Scowie as they help us through this process, and as well as the other members of the Property Tax Working Group. And I think everyone is trying to do what they can in order to help make this a better understandable system that encourages people to pay property taxes and use the system in the best way that we can use it.
Well, one of the comments I definitely picked up on from you is, and I appreciate so much, is the concept that we work on one program at a time around here, instead of looking at the entirety of the program, yeah, and the comprehensive nature of it. And I would say it goes even bigger than the Property Tax Working Group, because we also have to see it in the context of the income and sales taxes and the overall burden of folks. We're going to talk today about education finance and what that means to our property tax system when the state's responsibilities are shared with the local property tax owners, and it seems to me that the focus has been on a program by program review instead of a much more comprehensive conversation, which is so hard to have. And your work will form the basis of that bigger conversation on multiple levels, and that's why I'm so very grateful.
And if you do look at the history of the property tax, it's very clear that it is part of a system. You can't just look at one component of the property tax. You can't just look at the property tax. You really have to look at the system. And what happens to the income tax or the sales tax can affect what happens to the property tax. And those things all do interact in many ways. And I certainly look forward to a broader discussion about property tax reform and tax reform in general.
Well, I hope you're planning to come back anytime, but for sure right away with your report next legislative session so we can begin work.
Absolutely.
Immediately.
Thank
and
you.
Is it Governor Ramsey I need to learn more about?
Yes.
Okay.
Alexander
Ramsey.
A
little more reading.
he was the territorial governor and the second governor of the state of Minnesota, and apparently one of the only territorial governors that actually got elected to be a state governor. So
He sounds like an all-star. I'm going to do a little bit more research on Minnesota history. Senator Howe, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Madam Chair, I would echo our Madam Chair's comments. You know, I think it's vitally important. The question I have for you is if we do see something in our tax structure, our property tax structure, that needs to be adjusted or tweaked, do you think we should address that now, or should we wait for a final report to come out in 2013?
Well, it becomes difficult if the system changes through this process. You know, how it all fits together, and I'm certainly I can't say that there aren't things that need to be addressed this session, but I think the majority of things, if we go forward, will be addressed in the next session.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions or comments for the chair of the Property Tax Working Group?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for being here this morning. Members, as I said, we're also going to finish up our conversation. We're going to have phase two of our conversation about education finance. I don't think we're ever going to finish this conversation, but I learned a lot at the last meeting we had on this. I'm hopeful to continue learning about this subject. It's amazing how much of an impact the education finance system has on the property tax system in Minnesota, but the overall tax structure as well. And Mr. Nauman, I'm so glad you came back. Your presentation was thought-provoking, and I know you're going to provoke us some more this morning, and thank you for doing it.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best. It's always a little daunting to come to the Tax Committee. So, thank
we
you
all having. Feel the same way.
It's a little easier when there isn't a K-12 bill that we're working on at the same time. So we'll jump right in. Members will recall that we began last week, and I'll say thank you again for your interest. I'm going to throw up the table of contents. We got through maybe a third of what I had intended, and with the proviso that I have the shifts at the end. If you want to talk about those, I'll happily get into them, but they can be easily lopped off if we run short of time. So I think what I'll do is try to blaze past some of the slides that we had already talked about. These will be familiar. Stop me if we had some basic terms. We showed up some trends in school districts and charter schools. I think this is useful for when we start talking about some of the other trend data to keep that in mind. Here was the overall enrollment, and we had a conversation 2 weeks ago about breaking apart some of the school enrollment, so we scrubbed the data a little bit and have a little bit extra. This was something from last time as well, but this is new. There was conversation about the overall enrollment, how it broke out by region. And when we talk about regions in K-12, we often look at things on a strata basis. I've collapsed some of the traditional strata of non-metro smaller schools into a single non-metro line. But what this can show you is that some of the trends that is underneath the overall enrollment trends. So you see that I'll start with the I'll move left to right. We've broken out Minneapolis-St. Paul. You can see the blue diamonds. Kind of sounds like a Lucky Charms scenario. But Minneapolis-St. Paul have been in a relative enrollment decline, a little less than 100,000 pupils in the 98 time frame. And you can see that they're probably around the, I forget exactly, but a little over 75 maybe. Then the charter schools at the very bottom have been showing a fair bit of growth. And that's consistent because the charter school, that's exactly what's been happening. So the enrollment has been growing substantially in the charter schools. The other metro are our pink squares, and they've been on a pretty steady growth. And then the non-metro diamonds have been on a pretty healthy decline in that same period. So that's kind of what you would expect. It's kind of what the conversation that Senator Hoffman began 2 weeks ago. We'll see that also in the teacher data. But if you were to just take a look at that overall trend and just sort of graph it as a composition of the total, you can see the percentages have there been a little bit of change. So in 98, the non-metro was about 48%. Charter schools weren't even registering a full percent at that point. The 40% is the other metro, and then Minneapolis and St. Paul were at about 11. And at that time, Minneapolis was the largest school district in the state in terms of enrollment, and it's now about number three. And as you move all the way over to fiscal 11, that was last year, the charters are now occupying about the 4% figure. The green being the non-metro is at 44, so there's a decline there. The other metro is up to 42, and Minneapolis and St. Paul are down to 9. Is that helpful?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Nauman, what's number two? I mean, Oak and Hennepin and Minneapolis, what's number two?
Number two, in terms of overall size, I believe it's St. Paul at this point.
St. Paul bigger than Minneapolis?
Indeed.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair. I think it's worth noting, though, that Minneapolis is... experienced an enrollment increase in the last year or two.
Fair point.
Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Fair point.
Mr. Nauman.
Well, significant because it presents some challenges with respect to our facilities and class sizes and the like.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chair, then we saw this one last week, and this was the overall teacher FTEs, and we showed the secondary and pre-K elementary and special ed, and I made the point that it was notable that the special ed was on a somewhat of an increase, and the conversation then led to regional breaks on these as well, and you'll see the same overall trend here. So the non-metro in a bit of a decline, charters in growth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, in a bit of a decline, although not as large as what they saw in the enrollment. And then the other non-metro, relatively stable. So unless there's a desire to go into that in great detail, I'll put up the percentages because I think that's a little bit better way to look at it. And you see the same kind of trend here. Not surprising, the enrollment and the enrollment percentages are relatively close to what we see here on the teacher FTE strata comparison. So I hope that's helpful for that conversation. Then we began talking about the spending of revenue. We talked about this chart, making note of the increase in the state aid in the year of the big plan, the drop in state aid as a result of the federal ERA money. And some of the relative increase in overall revenues, but you see some of the components bopping around in some of those notable years. If there's interest, I can go into that again. Again, we show this as a component percentage.
Mr. Nauman, could you maybe give us a minute or two on the impact of the one-time federal and then how we covered that?
So what happened at that point is states were given a fairly intricate formula by the federal government to insert or basically replace their state aid formulas in their general funds with federal funds with some requirements that we not reduce the overall formulas. And Minnesota had about $500 million that it put into, well, exactly $500 million that it put into its general education formula. Essentially what we did was we figured out what the formula would cost in that year, and then we subtracted $500 million of state aid and inserted $500 million of federal funds that came from the federal ERA money. So that's why you see that little gully on the red line in fiscal 10 and then a little bit of a mountain on the federal line. Those two offset each other. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you.
And if you look at fiscal 10 on this chart, you can see that same dynamic where the federal funds up at the top increased to a 13% component where they were previously about 6, and they increased to 13%, and the state aid moved from 66% to about 59%. So you can see how that the effect of that policy affect the overall composition of education dollars at that point too. Okay. So then this is our last chart that we got to when we started talking about equalization. And what I'd like to mention here is that whenever you talk about education, you got to talk about both the property tax side and the state aid side in concert, because several of the formulas, many of the big formulas, have both a mix of both state aid and property tax levy. And this little chart here was my shorthand version of trying to illustrate how we set equalization in Minnesota. The wealthier districts per pupil receive having to raise a given amount of revenue off the property tax. The poorer districts per pupil, or the less wealthy districts per pupil, are going to get more state aid. And the policy decision is where that equalization breakpoint is. That's the slope of that line. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that in a few moments in a little more detail. But this was just conceptually how we work through that. So then, as I mentioned, and this is new stuff, it's important to talk about K-12 and both the aid side and the levy side. So I thought I'd give you a few pie charts on the aid side and then move directly into the property taxes. So in terms of Minnesota's overall budget, this is the all funds budget.
Hang on a sec there, Mr. Nauman. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I've got a question on the previous chart on the state aid levy split policy on 16. Would there be a way to plot school districts onto this chart here to see where they fall?
Indeed there would, Senator. I think if we were to go that route, I would kind of throw this chart out. Not because it's wrong, but because it's more of a concept piece than it is real data.
Okay.
So we could certainly do a chart that lays equalization on a given formula for all school districts across the state. We do that pretty routinely inside many of the K-12 formulas.
Would there be a way, Mr. Chair, would there be a way of getting that in a graph form like this where you could
certainly
throw them up and say, okay.
Certainly, we could put something like that together. The reason I say throw it out is because each of these formulas that I have under the examples is slightly different.
Right.
For example, the operating capital has one slope of a line. Equity's got a different slope because
sure.
It uses a different tax base. The operating referendum actually has two equalization slopes that break at a certain point.
Sure.
We talked about complexity in the previous conversation. I think we can keep up with the property tax system in K-12. So, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I just suggest that we'd want to do a chart that plots this for each of these various formulas. So we can talk about that in greater detail if you'd like. But it's a great question.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nauman, you talked about complexity and whether it was a good thing or not. And, of course, you know that all of these reasons that the formula is so complex is because they're trying to address an issue that came across by the public of the state of Minnesota. And, you know, I know it's great to try to simplify all this stuff, but isn't there an issue with the general uniform part of the Constitution that is not being well addressed by all of this complexity that we probably should take a little look at?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I somewhat flippantly responded making the parallel to the complexity conversation previously. Of course, you're 100% right that there are indeed policy choices that undergird every one of these complex issues that we talked about, both on the property tax side as well as in K-12. Legislators, your preceders, have made decisions to attempt to deal with some of the vexing policy questions before the state. Indeed, on K-12, we began this conversation with the Constitution for that very reason. And whether it is a system that is entirely working at this point, I'll leave that to be your judgment. Others have suggested that, you know, the courts have weighed in these questions in the past. I'm not going to presume that that's ultimately where we're headed, but there are relative opinions about whether or not the tax burden of an individual district relative to the tax burden of another district is fair, but certainly an interpretation of what education finance fairness is the reason why we have an equalization system like this on these various formulas. It's an attempt to reduce the overall or provide some fairness in rates. If you look at the rates, others have differing opinions, but there's some would argue that they're not, in fact, fair at this point. But that's an isolated part of the overall K-12 system. So it's a complex question, and that's one that I'd encourage you to wrestle with. Okay, so now we're just looking at how much in the all funds budget K-12 constitutes. So that's that little pink pie slice popping out the bottom. You can see that on the all funds budget that HHS is about 42.4% and K-12 is 25%. Both are the single largest two portions of the overall Minnesota state budget. But then if we drill down and just look at the general fund budget, you can see that they flip in terms of one and two. K-12 is a 40.2% of the general fund budget, and HHS drops to 32.6%. HHS has more of a mix of other funds that beyond the general fund, whereas K-12 is largely a general fund question. We don't talk too much about other funds in K-12.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahlman, in the forecast out, do they go out like 4 years, and do those percentages stay pretty stable, or are they moving around a bit?
They're relatively stable. You're going to get some changes in HHS, and I'm not the expert in that area, but others can speak to this point. I believe there's, you know, caseload tends to drive the HHS count. In K-12, I can tell you that the driver is obviously pupil counts, which we talked about earlier. They're on an upward projection. So we're going to get more spending based on the projection line in K-12. But in terms of a relative basis, these percentages have been fairly constant in recent years.
Mr. Nauman, Senator Scoy, I don't have these numbers on the top of my head, but I don't see, back to that slide, Mr. Nauman, on 17, I don't see anyway how that HHS chunk stays the same. I mean, given the retirement of the baby boomers and the aging of the population, there's just no way. There's going to be so much more pressure on that piece, and I think that's part of your point.
Well, that's what I was asking. If in the 4 years that they had, I assume you're looking out 4 years with the biennium and then the tails, if there was a lot of room.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I want to hasten to add, I'm not the HHS expert here, so I can speak to you about K-12 and we've got some pupil growth anticipated there. I think mm-hmm. the logic that you've identified, Mr. Chair, would hold some ground. If the committee is interested in this relative basis, we can do easily charts like this for the next biennium.
Yeah, and Senator Scoy, we hear that. That's Gillespie and Stinson, those kind of presentations talk a lot about that dynamic that you discussed. Okay. Mr. Nauman.
So then if we drill down a little bit further and look at just the general fund and how that breaks out by basic K-12, Madam Chair, we're on slide 19.
Thank you.
If you drill down into just the general fund budget and some of the basic important components of K-12, the general education budget, this is the big, what we often refer to as the formula. It's actually more of a combination of about 16 or 17 formulas. But that's about 81% of what we do. Some of the grants and some of the charter school expenditures is about 2.5. Special education is the second largest at about 13. Facilities, nutrition, and libraries, only about 1%. And again, this is just the state aid side of things. The early childhood budget is about 1.5%, and the agencies are about 0.5%. So most of the K-12 budget is really dollars passed through directly to districts. Okay, back to property taxes, which is why we're here. 2 weeks ago, Mr. Paulson spoke to you about special taxing districts, and this chart is designed to show you sort of the component pieces of the overall property tax system. So the schools, the chart on the left is the entire system. So schools constitute 27% of that, 73 being everything else. And then if you break that everything else out into its component pieces, counties at 33%, the special taxing districts that Mr. Paulson spoke about, 4%, the state general levy is 10% of the total, cities 23 and towns at 3. So this, I thought, gave you sort of a relative magnitude of what K-12 represented as part of the total. For the fiscal analysts in the room, this is a shorthand version of the K-12 property tax tracking spreadsheet that we bring to this committee whenever there's a K-12 bill that's moving through the legislature. This just shorthands it by basic E-12 property taxes by general fund, community service fund, debt service, OPEB, and the total levies. Of note, particular note to this committee, the credit changes that were enacted last year. You can see that credits and adjustment line was at about 72.9, and then goes up to about 15.1. So that's our tracking for that. There was an interest in talking and having a little bit of a look back at
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Back on that last chart. So the credits went from 72 to 15, and the total levy went from 21 to 22.8 or whatever. Is most of that levy due to that, or how much of that was due to voter-approved referendums and other things?
Well, we're going to talk about that in a moment, Senator Skoy,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Right.
What my intention is to sort of talk about the global property taxes and then sort of drill down, spend a little bit of time on the operating referendum. I think we'll see that the operating referendum over the last 10 years has been the primary driver of these property tax changes, and with obvious policy questions for you all to wrestle with. And I should perhaps rehand this spreadsheet out that we handed out last time in anticipation of that. And I guess, Senator Skoy, the general fund line does have the operating referendum levies in it. So you can see there's a lot more change there. I was just highlighting the credits because I know this committee has kind of wrestled with that question. So, Madam Chair, you asked me to take a little bit of a look back at the 2001 education reform. This was Governor Ventura's big plan. That constituted a whole series of property tax base changes, as well as some changes on the K-12 side. At the time, we had a general education property tax that was imposed at a rate evenly across all school districts. That levy was about $1.3 billion at the time. But it only cost the state about $880 million because there was a whole series of credits that were eliminated at the same time. So the net cost to the state was about $880 million to get rid of that $1.3 billion levy. On the K-12 side, there were also a couple of formulas that were eliminated at the time, the so-called supplemental and original transition revenue program. Those were both rolled on to the operating referendum. And then after rolling those formulas on, we moved $415 of referendum authority onto the general education formula allowance. So the way that worked was a school district that had $415 or more of operating referendum had that $415 subtracted off its operating referendum, and the formula allowance went up by $415. So it was a net movement of revenue that was generated off the operating referendum onto the formula allowance. A district that had less than 415 got some new money as a result of that it didn't previously have. The cost of rolling the referendum supplemental and transition was about $120 million on the state aid side. So Governor Ventura's intent at the time, he looked at these data. In fiscal 2002, the general education and referendum revenue sources together was about 67% state aid and 33% property tax in the general education program combined with the operating referendum. And in 2003, his goal was to eliminate it and have it go to 100%. In 2003, it was 96% and 4% property tax. And then since that time, we've creeped back a little, 86%, 14% property.
Mr. Nellen, can I interrupt? Because we are talking a little bit about the state general levy, which was part of the whole big plan. And while the property tax portion of the school funding has gone up, that also has gone up. It was intended that the state general levy would take over a portion of the property taxes, correct me if I'm wrong, that we're going to go to the schools, so that the business community at large could pay property taxes at the state level that would help offset some of the general fund expenses and bring down the local property tax burden And that hasn't happened because both have increased over that same period of time. Am I wrong about that?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'd hesitate to suggest you're wrong. What I would
it's okay. It happens at home all the time.
What I would suggest is that as part of the 2001 reform, that in order to balance all the books at that time, that the levy that you're now referring to was part of that overall package. There was a time for a number of years in which the growth in that levy was to be dedicated to education, and then I think a few years after that was put in place, it was then removed. What was also happening at the same time, and I'm sort of circling around your answer, is that the growth that you see in property taxes in education came for two reasons. Number one, we had originally eliminated all property taxes out of the education, general education finance formulas, but then our budgets went south in 2003 and 2005, and some levy was swapped, was inserted and swapped out for aid. So we converted state aid to levy in the K-12 side of things. And then when you add in a fairly aggressive property tax growth, that has tended to depress the state aid side of things, as well as increasing the property tax side of things on the K-12 side. So if the intent was, as you suggest, and I'll let others speak to what they intended at the time, subsequent dynamics, as well as the reliance on the operating referendum, which we're going to see in subsequent slides, has all tended to put some additional pressure on the K-12 property tax.
Thank you.
Well, and I hope that answers your question.
It does, and honestly, at moments like this, I kind of miss Senator Pogemiller. I mean, you and he probably know more about this subject than anybody at the Capitol, and I appreciate your bringing the history here. It's really important for us to understand what happened and what was intended to be accomplished by the 2001 reforms. I'm not sure that we've accomplished many of those goals. I mean, some of them, surely, but that's what we're dealing with now is, did that actually accomplish what it set out to do? And now we're looking at that statewide business property tax and saying, why did we do that, and what did we accomplish? And so that's why the timing of this presentation is so good and why I asked that complicated question. Thank you. Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, I was here at the time that reform was done and the state general tax was contemplated and passed into law. And the reason the chamber supported it is they got a really sweet deal. And what bothers me is now today they want to revisit the issue, because what they got was, we took a look in 2001, we took a look at the tax capacity of all commercial industrial property in the state. We decided how much money we needed to raise for schools at the time, and it was around $560 million. There was a number, five something. And we decided that's what we need out of the business community for schools. And when you calculated that back as a percentage of overall tax capacity of commercial industrial property, there was a percentage. A certain percentage of tax capacity is going to go to schools. And then where the business community got the sweet deal is, rather than adjust it for future changes in overall tax capacity of commercial and industrial, we just put an inflation factor on it. So the state general tax only goes up by the rate of inflation every year. It is not adjusted for the overall change in commercial industrial tax capacity. So what has happened, as new buildings get built or as values go up, unlike other property, where when your values go up like that, it's very likely that your property taxes are going to go up. And in commercial industrial, what happens is your rate goes down. And that's where we're currently at today. If you look at total commercial industrial tax capacity, the percentage that is assessed for the state general tax now is a considerably lower percentage than it was in 2001. They got a really sweet deal. That's why they signed off on it. And now they want to forget about all that history. But Mr. Paulson, I'm sure, can give us the percentage of overall commercial industrial tax capacity that goes, that's assessed for the state general tax. And it's been a really good deal, because every year it's a smaller percentage of tax capacity that is assessed for the state general tax. And I think that's a very, very important point to make. I think the business community did a very good job in 2001. No other property gets treated like that, where your class rate actually goes down over time, where your property only goes up by the property tax only go up by the rate of inflation.
I think your command of the facts is really good, Senator Bach, and I've been doing a little research on this as well, and I think the number I heard was 540, but maybe it was 560. I mean, you might be right, that back in 2001, that's what that tax was intended to be, to raise $540 million. But it's $800 million now, and the property values have not increased. They've gone down, and so it's been a huge burden for the business community, and we're losing businesses in the state. And I'm not talking about necessarily big businesses. I'm talking about in the rural towns and cities, businesses are shutting their doors and there are vacancies all over. And we have to look at that in this committee. We are going to look at it in future hearings. I know there are many of us that have signed on to bills for a change in that statewide business property tax and are working very hard. I had a very productive meeting with the governor yesterday. He was very interested in that inflator and what the impact is on businesses in the state of Minnesota, and I'm hoping to pursue that. So I hope all of us will do all we can to get up to speed on this. That's why we're having a presentation like this, so we can all come back to the table and roll up our sleeves, work together, and figure out how do we address this, what I think is a growing problem in our property tax system.
Well, Senator Ortman, I just would caution you to say that $800 million is a larger percentage of overall commercial industrial tax capacity than $541 was in 2001, because I don't believe that's accurate. Now, Mr. Paulson can get you that information, I'm sure, but their percentage of tax capacity that goes to commercial industrial taxes, unless something has radically changed in the last year from when I chaired this committee, is less than it was in 2001. And, Senator Ortman, you're exactly right. We're creating a real problem on main streets, especially in small towns. And this committee did a big piece of work last year by the market value exclusion on homes, trying to mitigate the impact of the elimination of the homestead credit. Much of that property tax burden, and I give you credit for trying to mitigate the impact on homes, but the burden shifted to main streets and to small commercial industrial properties. So I don't blame them for screaming. But it wasn't an accident. I didn't vote for it. I don't believe one Democrat voted for getting rid of the homestead credit and then shifting that burden onto small businesses. And I look forward to working with you to try and fix it.
Well, Senator Bach, with all due respect, that there were two parts to what was a property tax initiative in our tax bill last year, and it included the phase-out and elimination of the statewide business property tax. And the governor vetoed that. So when the businesses come back and say, this is a challenge for us, I would say, it is a challenge, and unfortunately, the governor vetoed what was a really key portion of property tax relief that this Senate Tax Committee authorized and the Senate authorized last year. So that's why we're going to keep working on it. We're going to hopefully educate the governor. You can help us with that. This is a very important reform, how we do it, what the elements of it are, how quickly we can do it. All of those things are up for discussion. We're going to have Mr. Paulson back in, but we need your help to get this right.
Senator Ortman, I'll be glad to help. It would be helpful if somebody would listen going forward to what, because the history is important. And Mr. Nauman and Mr. Paulson were all here. But we need to not mix the two issues. Local property taxes and state general taxes are different issues. The state general tax goes to the state's general fund. What happened with the elimination of the market value credit, homestead credit, had nothing to do with the state general tax. We shifted the local property tax burden in a lot of small towns from homeowners to main streets, the local property tax burden.
Well, Senator Bach, I agree that it is for all of us to look at, but when you're a property taxpayer in the state of Minnesota and 30% of your property taxes, if you're a business owner, goes to the state, I'm not sure you really distinguish the difference and say, well, that's the state and that's a different purpose. No, you're paying property taxes on your property, some of it to the cities, schools, counties, but I'm not sure why the state is in that business at all. And I think that's my bigger question. It's more of a purpose question. What was the purpose? We're trying to accomplish some things, raise money from businesses to pay for schools, but the schools, the counties, and the cities have every ability to raise those taxes. We don't need to do it for them. And I think we got caught in the middle. We tried to accomplish something, but we didn't do it. And now, unfortunately, those businesses are ending up paying both. The schools are raising property taxes and referendums to pay for schools for portions of funding that they don't get from the state. And I think we got the worst of both worlds is what I'm saying. So now it's time for us to go back and say, can we address some of the problems that we created with a fix that didn't really accomplish what it was set out to do?
Well, Senator Russ, my only word of caution is, please do not characterize it reform. It is reducing or phasing out the state general tax is not property tax reform. It is just lowering business taxes, much of which those benefits are going to go to out-of-state corporations. It's not reform. Reform is when we reshuffle the deck, like was done in 2001. The conversation we probably need to have relative to school funding, if people don't like the state general tax, is taking a look at the way schools were funded prior to 2001 with a state general education levy, and we could probably get rid of, talk about getting rid of the state general tax completely. If we revisited prior to 2001, which was really the end of the Minnesota miracle and the end of the state general education levy.
But, Senator Bach, this is where you and I disagree. Changing and eliminating the statewide business property tax is absolutely a reform, and it's part of a reform that was a two-part package last year, and that's how we see it. It was to address some of the problems in our property tax system with the market value homestead credit that was not being funded properly at the state. And one of the ways to address that was to make sure that there wasn't an impact to homeowners and business property property taxpayers. Two parts of the reform. We're going to continue with our reform efforts on the statewide business property tax. As I said, we need your help, and we're going to need the participation of the governor if we're going to really help these businesses. Senator Rust, I'm sorry. It took
so
long.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think it's important to keep in mind the history, as Senator Bach has been pointing out. And, you know, I would ask the business community, would they rather participate in supporting schools through the property tax, through the system that we had prior to the 2001 reforms or changes, if you don't want to call it reform, the changes that were made then, and if they now think that was a better system, a fairer system, where there was a disparate burden throughout the state, depending on where your business was located, and they would like to go back to that system as their participation, then I think we need to hear from them on that. And some of us over this last decade really did think we should revisit the formula by which business, the CI property, participated across the state, so it was kind of smoothed out, whether it's $540 million or $800 million, and I do think it's important to understand it as a percentage of tax capacity across the state. But was there a better way? Should we have taken what's the amount that we want or that we believe is a fair share amount for the business community to be participating in support for education, and determine that amount and then spread it across the state rather than having an automatic formula that is an inflator. And I think, you know, that's still worthwhile thinking about. And then just as an aside, you referenced that Senator Pogemiller, former Senator Pogemiller, and Mr. Nauman were the probably the only people that really understand everything that he's presented here today. But I will point out that although former Senator Pogemiller negotiated this reform, he voted against it. He voted no on his own bill. So let's just remember all the history and not just part of it.
Senator Roman, I could add something to that.
Senator Buck, I wasn't here, so we're all learning and we're all ears.
Senator Johnson,
we were here.
Senator Johnson, the state's longest-serving tax chair, voted no on that bill. Senator Moe, the majority leader of the Senate, voted no on that bill. It wasn't the best product. And I think the business community needs to be reminded that that $541 million, if that was the number, the $800 today, all that is an inflation-adjusted number. If we had had no inflation since 2001, the reality is they're still at $500 in inflation-adjusted dollars. They're paying the same amount this year that they paid in 2001 when the reform was done.
Senator Buckeye and Senator Rest, thank you for your comments and a little more history. Every time we can learn a little more about what was happening in 2001, I think it's better for the conversation we're beginning about the statewide business property taxes. I would say we might want to look at the different ways to measure what the businesses are paying.
Exactly.
Because one of the numbers I recently learned is that they represent 13% of the market value in the state. Businesses do, but they pay 30% of the property taxes. And so maybe your CI tax capacity is a good measurement. Maybe this way is a good way to measurement. I'm hoping we're going to look at all of them and see what we can do to help, because I think that's our responsibility this year, is to help these businesses so they can stay in business, they can afford their property taxes, they can reinvest in jobs, in the community, in research and development, and all those things. It will help all of us if we can roll up our sleeves, use that history to our best effort, and make some improvements here on their behalf. Senator Rest and then Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, piggyback on something that Senator Bach had, I think we really do need to make very judicious use of the word reform, however. Merely shifting burden from one classification in the property tax system to another does not make for a better system if it's going to upset the relationship. I think we really need to understand what that relationship is, and what is a fair relationship. It used to be too when we would give a break, and I'm not recommending this because it has its own problems necessarily. I'm not recommending it, but when we would give a break in a classification rate to a particular kind of property, we would so-called pay for it. We would make sure that there was dollars that went out from the state general fund that did not, as we were giving relief to one set of property owners, that we were not increasing the burden on the other. And we did that through something called Homestead Agricultural Credit Aid, HACA, we used to call it, where we would reimburse the cities and the counties for that that burden relief so that it would not be burden shift. One of the problems with getting rid of the market value homestead credit last year is that we didn't pay for the shift onto other properties. And we can say we didn't have the money. We didn't have the $300, $280 million, whatever it was. But it was, even if it was a flawed system, the market value credit system, certainly when on property tax statements there was just a bald-faced lie about what was going out to local governments, it still had an impact on the property taxpayer. And we were not able to, perhaps from your point of view, we did not, as a fact, mitigate that impact at all, and we're paying the piper this year, whether it is through wanting to reduce the impact on the shift that went on to businesses or even the shift that went back on to other homes. So it's a much broader issue in my mind than just let's see if we can stimulate business activity in Minnesota, which we all like to do, by
we don't.
Cherry picking one policy, the business statewide business property tax, and saying that's the one we're going to get rid of, and do it. It might be fine, but do it without shifting the burden onto another class of property taxpayers like renters.
Senator Rust, that was my point entirely. which was last year, it was a much broader effort to reform property taxes, including both the market value homestead credit, the exclusion, and the phase out of the business property tax to minimize any impact from what was an overall reform. Senator Howe, I'll ask you to be brief, and then we're going to get back to Mr. Nauman. And I'm going to ask you, Mr. Nauman, to work on maybe go to the operating referendum slides that
Madam,
are so good.
And I have a question on this.
Okay, just one moment. And then we do have Superintendent Corlett from Norwood Young America. So we're going to try and be very brief now and hopefully not go more than a couple minutes past our time. So we're going to move to Senator Howe. Please be very brief, then Senator Scoy, and then Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment, and of course, I wasn't here when they made this change either, but it seemed like we wanted to gather all the money equally from property-rich districts and property-poor districts and put all that money together. But it seems when we went to redistribute it, it wasn't distributed just as a pupil was a pupil across our state, and it wasn't evenly distributed. And there's a formula that distributes this pot of money, and that also picks winners and losers. So it seemed like we wanted to get all the money coming in at one spot, and that's one of the reasons I asked for that. I'd like to see how that money is distributed or our plot graph to see where that's going, because it would seem on one end if we're taking all the money in from across the state, it should be distributed evenly, and districts need to learn to operate and then use their local property to adjust for any inequities, because we know certain districts are different with different issues. But just a comment.
And Senator Howe, that is why Mr. Corlett is here, to show how what this means for him as a superintendent of a school district impacted by what we do. And just for an example, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a question for Mr. Nauman. I just have a couple of quick comments. With regard to the discussion you guys have been having, remember Governor Ventura proposed to pay for this property tax relief with a sales tax expansion, which didn't occur, and we've been dealt a hand of a decade of deficits because of that. I mean, he was going to do state money, local property tax relief, and probably ought to revisit that. To the 415 roll-in that Mr. Nauman talked about, I think we need to be clear that every school district got $415. Some of it used it for property tax relief because they had more than $415 a referendum. If a school district didn't have $415 a referendum, they got money for schools. So, but they all got the money. It's just where they used it. But the real point on this slide that needs to be made in relation to the 2001 reform is the property tax levy that occurred prior to the reform. A lot of that was fully equalized gen ed levy. And it was then assessed based on the valuations of the jurisdiction. And what's happened in the intervening time, we've gone to these other levies. They're equalized differently. Some are not equalized at all. So we have a whole different group of people paying property tax that paid prior to 2001 because of the differing equalizing formulas. And I think Mr. Nauman's going to get to that at some point. But all levies just aren't the same. Even though when you look at that graph, you say, oh, well, there's 30% and 14% or whatever. Within that number, it's a significant change that's gone on for individual property taxpayers. And Senator Howe, to your point about collecting money across the state and redistributing it out, that's the point of the equalizing formulas, is so it's done fairly.
Members and Mr. Nauman, I am going to ask you to be flexible. And Mr. Nauman, it looks like you're going to win a free trip back to the tax committee. Will you please come back? Because this is obviously of great interest to all of us, and we are learning a tremendous amount by what you're sharing with us. But I do want to accommodate Superintendent Corlett. He came from Norwood Young America this morning, and I really appreciate him being here. And so, Mr. Corlett, if you're prepared, do you want to come up and just talk about what's happening in Norwood Young America as a function of the state's funding or financing and local financing of school district expenses? If you don't mind, Mr. Nauman, I hope you'll stay at the
Madam
table
Chair,
with us.
I'm pleased to. I think we got through seven slides this time, so that we did better than the last time. But I think that of importance is the questions that you're wrestling with. I think that's the point. So.
I think this is maybe one of the most important conversations we've had at the Capitol since I've been here. So thank you, Mr. Nauman, for your work. Members, it's a great pleasure to have with us Brian Corlett, the superintendent of the Norwood Young America School District. And I've worked with him for several years, and it's a great pleasure to work with him. And I really appreciate, Mr. Corlett, your coming this morning to tell us how things are going there. Members, I also invited Dr. Peterson from the Minnetonka School District. They both came to talk to me on the same day about what was happening in their schools, and so I asked Dr. Peterson to come as well. And very briefly, I'm going to set the stage for Mr. Corlett's comments by saying that the School District of Minnetonka would be asking us to take a cap off of their levy authority today. And the School District of Minnetonka would be telling you what Dr. Peterson told me, and this is opposite ends of my district, that they recently passed a technology referendum. And they recently issued an iPad to every ninth grader in the Minnetonka School District, and it is their plan to have learning plans on these iPads going forward. And they're going to issue iPads to every ninth grader every year. And then I'm sure they're going to have to replace them as the technology advances. And that's an amazing commitment. Now, if you want to talk about equalization in funding, I'm not sure Norwood Young America has ever dreamed of issuing an iPad to every student in the ninth grade class. And so this is what we're talking about, Senator Howe, Senator Skoy. And are we providing the same level of educational opportunity to all Minnesotans? And what does that constitutional requirement mean for a property tax and taxation system? Senator Skoy?
Well, Madam Chair, I wasn't going to comment, but I would be curious to know how many iPads there are in the Clearbrook-Gonvick School District. I'm 100% sure that it isn't all the students. They just don't have the resources to do that, no matter what. You know, they couldn't raise it locally.
Right. Well, with that, members, Mr. Corlett, thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to us this morning. My name is Brian Corlett. I'm the superintendent of schools at Central Public Schools, Norwood Young America. We sit on the western edge of Carver County. We're basically a rural farming community. Our school district consolidated in 1911 between the two cities of Norwood and Young America. Since then, we've added the city of Hamburg and the city of Cologne, as well as the surrounding areas. This is my seventh year as the superintendent in Central Schools, also my seventh year in Minnesota, and I've had quite an exciting time finding my way through the school finance and property tax systems in Minnesota these last 7 years. Being located on the western edge of Carver County, we experience a lot of the benefits of the metro area. We're just 15 minutes basically outside the metro, but we also experience the taxes, the property costs associated with being located near the metro area. I have three slides for you today, so I think we'll get through all of mine. Number one, our funding from the state is somewhat low. We're 294th out of 35 or 36 districts in the state. We're 241st in general ed and alternative comp revenue. That is something that the state has us listed in. However, we don't participate in the alternative comp program, so we would drop even farther down. Overall, when you include special ed revenue, we're 206th overall, so we're in about the bottom one-third of the revenue. You get a few. We have about 1,000 students in our school district, K-12. You get a few very high-need special ed kids that are very expensive, and that brings your special ed costs up considerably, especially in a district our size. We also are a district with not a lot of business property. We're more houses and more commuters to work from where we live. It's about 45 minutes to downtown Minneapolis from where we're at, so most of our folks do not work in the communities in which we live. As you talk about property taxes and referendum revenue, one of the things that we experience being a low property wealth district is the fact that we have a $500 per student referendum that's been in place since 2003. It was renewed in 2008. Our taxpayers pay $101 per $100,000 of taxable value. The same amount of property taxes paid in West Tonka nets them $1,480 worth of referendum revenue. Being a low property wealth district, it's much harder for our taxpayers to fund school levies. And this is, I believe, up to date. As you see, the average state school district operating referendum right now is $1,029 per student. We're sitting just less than half of that. The other thing that has really affected us recently is the equalization factor. When you talk about our equalized levies, in 2003, which was 2 years before I came to the district, we were getting about 46% of our referendums equalized. Then, of course, the housing bubble came and the inflated prices on the houses, and I think they're more artificial prices than anything else, came. And as you can see, over the last 9 years, our referendums has increased, our equalized referendums have increased, but our student enrollment has also increased, which leads to additional income as that happens. However, as you can see right now, the amount of equalization that we receive on our referendums is about 9%, a little under 9%, versus about 43% back in 2003. So what one of the things that of course, the Schools for Equity in Education talks about is trying to make this a system that is much more equitable for all the school districts across the state. And property-poor districts such as us, and we're not the most property-poor district, but considering our neighbors, Chaska, Edina, Wayzata, some of those places, were considered a property-poor district.
Mr. Corlett, can you go back to the second slide? Did I hear you say that $100,000 in value on a home yields you $101? Is that what that says?
What that says is if you look at our school district, Central NYA, the second one there, we have a $500 per student operating referendum. On $100,000 of value, if your house is worth $100,000, it's taxed at $101 per year. The same house that's valued at $100,000 in West Tonka nets them $1,480 worth of referendum revenue, and their taxes are $111.
Why is that?
Just because of the difference in the property values across the school districts.
Mr. Nauman, maybe you can address that.
This is the point that I made when Mr. Nauman was here 2 weeks ago about this equalizing formulas and their theory about trying to have a $100,000 house raise a comparable amount of revenue. We had a little give and take on that, but because of the values, as the superintendent is talking about, it saved the state a lot of money, but it's causing these school districts a lot of hard times funding their schools because the equalizing formulas hasn't been adjusted to take into account the inflation in values.
Mr. Nauman, can you?
Madam Chair, members, I think there's a little bit of blending of some issues here, and it's understandable. It's a complex question.
Right.
What the state has done on the operating referendum is set an equalization level. That's sort of that line where the split between the aid and the levy rests. We calculate that each district on that line relative to how much property tax base there is per pupil in each district. And we're looking at more than just the home values in that property, but all the property values, and then we make a calculation on a district by district basis to determine how much of it is aid, how much of it is levy to raise a given amount of revenue. So what happens is if over time that same amount of revenue remains constant, but the school district slides along the line to the right and they get essentially more wealthier per pupil, you then that school district will then appear wealthier to the school to the school formulas and have to raise more levy before the state aid kicks in. So what the superintendent is describing is a dynamic where for a certain amount of revenue, they now have to raise more levy to get state aid. The total revenue, the amount that the district spends in this example is constant, but the blend of state aid and levy changes over time if the property becomes higher valued.
Mr. Corlett, do you know the average or the per pupil spending? When I talked to Dr. Peterson, he said that Minnetonka was below the state average for per pupil spending. Can you comment on where Norwood Young America falls in on that?
We would be below the state average as well. I think we're under $9,000 per pupil, which would be, I would guess, somewhere in the lower two-fifths of the state.
And do you think, I mean, just generally speaking, that it's adequate, the per pupil dollars that you have, or is that what we should be looking at? Is it the source of funds that fund our schools that has a higher priority, or is it that you're just not getting enough to educate the kids on a per pupil basis?
Well, I think one of the issues that we are concerned with is that there is the disparity between, you know, the schools at the bottom of the list are running their districts on $8,000 per student, and the schools at the top of the list are running their districts on $12,000 or $13,000 per student. Our district, for instance, I'm the superintendent, I'm the business manager, I'm the human resources person. If we had a communications director, I would be that person as well. So we don't have a lot of the extras that go along with a lot of those things. A lot of our activity programs have to fundraise to do some of the things that they do. A lot of our athletic programs fundraise to do some of the things that they do. So we don't spend a lot of money unwisely. Our teachers come to the negotiating table, and they're very good about what they do. They understand. For instance, both of the last 2 years, they've asked for a 1% raise each year, which makes that part of it easy for us. As far as additional funds, we would certainly like to be able to offer some additional programs. We have just two vocational programs throughout our district. We'd like to be able to offer the orchestra, and we'd like to be able to upgrade our technology in an ongoing fashion and those kind of things. And we've done some of that, but we have to kind of do it where we can.
Mr. Corlett, it used to be, and I don't know whether this is true since you've been there, that open enrollment is a draw away the kids out of the community that you serve in to Waconia and Chaska. Is that still a big factor, and what's the trend on that?
Well, we are still losers in open enrollment. When I arrived 7 years ago, we lost about two out for every one in. Now we're down to about one and a half out for every one in. So some of that is starting to change a little bit. Having choice for students is a good thing. We fully support that. I think if you go and look through school districts across the state of Minnesota, you're going to find great things happening in every district. I don't think there's a great deal of difference in the quality of teachers or those types of things as you go from one place to another. Some of it's convenience. One of our cities sits 4 miles from Waconia, and a lot of parents work in Waconia.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for members? Superintendent, I really appreciate your coming to kind of give us some context for the conversation that we're having today. We're going to continue talking about this, and so any information you have for us that would help us understand what your challenges are, we would appreciate that greatly.
Thank you Thank you very much for having me today.
Thank you. And Mr. Nauman, we're going to look forward to adding you back into the schedule. And you may have to come back four or five times. We may punch your ticket five, six times. We'll just see. But members, with that, we are adjourned.